Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 2nd of December. First hour of our program today, we'll talk about the president's address at West Point concerning Afghanistan. He did say it is in our vital national interest to be sending more troops to Afghanistan. That's the hard question. He said that there were these concerns, and he addressed those, whether or not this would be another Vietnam, why it is that we can't leave right now because the country would slowly deteriorate more than it has in the last couple of years. And some critics are saying that the time frame should be open-ended, but he quoted Eisenhower and said that, indeed, that should not be the case. We're going to be talking about Afghanistan, already have, with John Munson. Later tonight, there will be a special at 7 o'clock this evening. It's an NPR news special on President Obama's decision regarding troop levels in Afghanistan. This is from 6, I'm sorry, it's tonight from 6 to 7 on the Ideas Network, and you're invited to listen to that. Ben Marins will have a show on this afternoon. Our guest this hour, Juan Cole, wrote in a blog yesterday, months after the controversial presidential election that many Afghans consider stolen, there is no cabinet. Parliament is threatening to go on recess before confirming a new one because the president is unconstitutional late in presenting the names. There are grave suspicions that some past and present cabinet members have engaged in the embezzlement of substantial sums of money. There is little parliamentary oversight. Almost no one bothers to attend the parliamentary sessions. The cabinet ministries are unable to spend the money allocated to them on things like education and rural development. Only half of the development projects for which money was allocated were even begun last year, and none was completed. Juan Cole is our guest this hour. He is the Richard Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan, and he's author of a number of books, including Sacred Space and Holy War in Napoleon's Egypt. Our phone number, we will be swamped with calls, I'm sure, as you all respond to what you heard last night, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Juan Cole, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Kathleen.
Well, your blog certainly described what a mess the Iraqi government is in right now. Tell me how in the world, because it seems as though you're going to have a real change in government in order for anything to work in Afghanistan.
Right. Well, you're not going to have a change in government because Afghanistan held its presidential elections on August 20th, and in a very flawed and mysterious process, Hamid Karzai, the incumbent, has emerged as the winner. He's going to be there for 5 years at least, and he's choosing the cabinet, and it will be his cronies. Karzai's brothers play a very important and behind-the-scenes role. They are widely considered corrupt, so it's going to be the same elite there that has been there for the past few years under which the situation has deteriorated in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. The president said that he asked one, I guess this would be the hardest question, is it in our vital national security for us to send 30,000 more troops? What about our national security? Is al-Qaeda strong and growing? Is it a threat to us right now?
There is no al-Qaeda in Afghanistan.
There is no al-Qaeda in Afghanistan?
There's no al-Qaeda in Afghanistan.
It's in Pakistan?
Well, to the extent that it's anywhere, there are some cells in Pakistan. You know, Kathleen, I have to say that I find this whole al-Qaeda thing mysterious now because it is constantly paraded before us as the reason for which we need, you know, a $600 billion defense budget. And we need to be fighting wars all around the world and so forth. But ordinarily, when you have an enemy, like when we had the Soviet Union as our enemy, there are statistics, like how many tanks do they have, how many troops do they have, where are they stationed, those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
How many al-Qaeda are there?
I don't know.
I don't know either. I specialize in this stuff. I mean, wouldn't we want to know that? How many are there exactly? And people say, well, they're in 60 countries, but when you look at it, it's like five guys in a gym someplace. So I really am a little bit afraid that this thing is being hyped. You know, Hitchcock, the film director, used to say that what drove a thriller is a MacGuffin. And it didn't really matter what it was. You know, it's like the Maltese Falcon, so you're chasing the Maltese Falcon. And I think that some of this talk about Al-Qaeda, even Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, is a MacGuffin to make the military-industrial complex go.
So who is it that is fighting us in Afghanistan and in Pakistan? Who are the people who have terrorized Pakistanis along the border? Who's fighting us in Afghanistan?
Pushtuns. This really has to be emphasized. Both Afghanistan and Pakistan are multi-ethnic states. Afghanistan consists of Persian-speaking Tajiks. They're similar to their dialect is different, but their language is the same as in Iran. They are, however, Sunni Muslims, not Shiites. Then there are Hazara Shiites, who I think are probably about 22% of the population in Afghanistan. There are Uzbeks up north who speak Turkic. And then about 42% of the population, we think, in the east and the south of the country are Pushtuns. And Pushtuns are characterized on the whole by clan society. They're very rural. For the most part, they do have some cities like Kandahar and Peshawar, but they have had a hard ride in modernity. The British attempted to dominate them, and then the Soviets attempted to dominate them. And being rural and clannish and religious, they fought off those foreigners, and now they think that the United States is trying to dominate them, You know, it is a kind of civil war inside the Pushtuns, in the sense that the majority of Pushtuns don't like the religious extremists, but a significant proportion of Pushtuns thinks highly of them. And it is those religious nationalists among the Pushtuns that the United States is fighting in Afghanistan and NATO is fighting. And it is religious extremists in Pushtun areas of northern Pakistan, which are blowing up things in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. So would you say, though, that their philosophy, it may be identical, similar to Al-Qaeda's philosophy, so they are a threat to us?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, it is true that Mullah Omar and the old Taliban gave safe haven to Al-Qaeda. But the two are extremely different. The Taliban have traditionally been inward-looking, and the other religious nationalists among the Pushtuns have been all about national autonomy. And it is true that both Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and some of the other religious movements among the Pushtuns emphasize strict Islamic law and so forth, but that's not the most important thing. Most important thing is that Al-Qaeda is, in design, an international asymmetrical terrorist group aimed at overthrowing governments around the world, of inflicting harm on the West as much as possible, and so forth. The Taliban and the other Pushtun groups have never been about internationalism of any sort, and they simply, in my view, don't form a threat to the United States. If you look at incidents of international terrorism, Afghans are almost never involved. And there was one recent case in New York where an Afghan was involved, but this is very rare.
The president, some have said that he dithered on this decision, but he did take his time, I guess, 4 months, had a lot of people come in and talk to him. Why do you think he chose this route, Juan?
Well, I don't know what's in the president's mind. I think he does believe that there are security issues here, that he doesn't want to see Afghanistan deteriorate into chaos. I think he's afraid that it would destabilize Pakistan and destabilize South Asia, might destabilize Central Asia as well. So, you know, great powers are status quo powers. They don't want things getting worse than they are. They kind of like things the way they are. And I think this was a status quo move, is to shore up the status quo to prevent it from going south. I think that it has elements of political compromise for the left. There's a three-year putative timetable for withdrawal. For the right, there's a troop escalation and a dedication to counterinsurgency. In some ways, you know, it may be political. I don't know. I'm not making the accusation. There are others who have said that you can't be reelected and end two wars. It may be necessary to double down on Afghanistan just to stay in the political game.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there is little doubt that it will go south, no matter what happens here?
Well, I think that the American conception of what a country and a society is just doesn't work very well in Afghanistan. It's Hatfields and McCoys over there. Most of the country is rural. The urban population, I don't think, is more than 20% of the country. Literacy is 28%. People are organized by kinship networks. We call them tribes sometimes, but they're more like clans. And they feud with each other. And they feud on all kinds of bases. And nowadays, you know, religion is one of the bases for their feuds, or whether you're allied with Karzai or not, or whether you like NATO or not. But a lot of it is clan feuds. And, you know, and sometimes people switch sides. It's fluid. A lot of what we call the Taliban had not been Taliban before the rise of the Taliban. They just switched sides and joined them. And then when the U.S. came in 2001, they put back on white turbans and declared themselves freedom fighters, anti-Taliban. So, you know, the idea that there's some magical way in which you could make this feuding clan society settle down is, I think, just inappropriate. There's going to be feuds going on there. There's going to be political instability. The place is full of weapons, and there are competing clans, tribes, ethnic groups, linguistic groups, political parties. So, you know, it's not going to be Sweden.
Mm-hmm. I was interested, and I must say I share her concern about this, because we have seen some images of women who have been able to shed the burqa, of women who have been able to go to school, of women who were not disfigured by acid thrown on them when they were going to school. We have a belief, at least, and tell me if I'm wrong, that this has changed somewhat. I was interested in what Illinois Representative Jan Schakowsky had to say, one of course, President Obama's most ardent supporters. We met her when we took our show to Iowa. She said, and I think that there are others who feel this way, that her concern for Afghan women has made her decision here a difficult one. She's skeptical about a troop increase, but I think of those images as well. I think about the plight of women there and how it's really been, you know, a turn to God knows what kind of society they were living in, and a little bit of freedom coming their way. And it's a haunting image to think of them becoming what they have been.
Well, I share your concern for Afghan women, but I have to say that the way American politics configures Afghanistan doesn't really fit very much with what's going on the ground. And there are issues in kind of feminist imperialism that one could broach, because there are other places in the world where women's status is low, mm-hmm. where they are in some ways mistreated by the wider society. It's very patriarchal. Whether we should be having 100,000 troops in each of those countries to liberate their women, it seems to me to be not ever broached. I mean, it's only with regard to Afghanistan. And so, you know, after the fall of the Taliban, it is true that the women's positions improved marginally in some cities, in Mazar-e-Sharif in the north, in Kabul. But you take a province like Herat, and Esmail Khan regimented women not quite as badly as the Taliban, but not so differently either. Now, the Taliban are a kind of patriarchal cult. Their ideas on women are frankly weird, and they are weird from the point of view of the Islamic tradition. The Prophet Muhammad said, seek knowledge even unto China. He didn't make it gender-specific. Even Saudi Arabia educated its women at a high level, and the king has just opened the first co-ed university. So the Taliban seem actively afraid of women who can read and write, and they put restrictions on them with regard even to education. And it's a strange cultish ideology that came out of the maelstrom of the 5 million Afghans that were displaced abroad and 2 million displaced internally during the Soviet period. I think it may be a little bit of a reaction to communism. One of the things that Westerners forget is that if you went back to 1985, you'd find Afghanistan as the communist socialist republic of Afghanistan. And women would be massively being educated and put in professions and, under Soviet tutelage, sort of forcibly liberated. And the rural tribes people revolted against that, and they're still revolting against that kind of thing. So I just don't think you can get, women's liberation at the point of the gun. And I think the Taliban are surely a danger to women's welfare, but most of the groups that U.S. and NATO are fighting in Afghanistan are not Taliban. They're other forms of religious nationalism.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our lines are all filled for this discussion. Juan Cole is our guest this hour. Juan is the author of a number of books, and he has been with us from time to time to talk about the Mideast. He is at the University of Michigan, where he is Richard Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History. Our phone number, lines will eventually open, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We get a phone calls now for Juan, starting from David, who's calling from San Francisco, California. Hi, David.
Oh, hi, Kathleen and Juan. I wanted to talk about the idea that we've gotten ourselves tricked into having a war without end, and contractors with secret contracts that give them guaranteed profits. So you have guaranteed profits in a war without end. And that seems to me to be one of the most preposterous things that you could ever have, that we, the taxpayers, can't find out how our money is being spent because it's top secret, and then we've given contractors guaranteed profits in a war without end. Before I went into that, he mentioned the Hatfield-McCoy, the historical Hatfield-McCoys. And I just wanted to remind him that back in the 1970s, the Hatfields and McCoys patched it up, and I believe they still have an annual picnic. So, he's aware too of the CIA's technique. Ever since the end of World War II, the CIA was going out into Eastern Europe and the Soviet bloc and gathering every bit of historical knowledge of the Montague, Capulet, Hatfield McCoys of the Middle East, Soviet Union, and they essentially used all that data to play various portions of the Soviet Union and tear it apart. So that's how they got the Soviet bloc to break apart, by using all of those old enmities. And so that data is still sitting around, whether or not the Hatfields and McCoys back in Hungary or in Chechnya or where else have patched it up 1,000 years ago. The CIA still had and gathered that data so that they could create these civil wars and rife. I was also going to raise the idea that with global warming, we've got to change our budget priorities. And for Obama to continue on this huge lie, a war that was created on lies and is now compounded by the fact that we know that bin Laden was allowed to escape in order to allow this massive looting of the U.S. Treasury. Obama is just walking himself into an enormous trap. He's walking we, the taxpayers, into it. It's all top secret. We don't get the right to find out how our money is being spent. At the very time that we're going to train new soldiers in Afghanistan to fight this crazy war.
All right, let's get a response here. We have tons of callers today. Professor Cole.
Well, the caller made a number of points. Let me just address the first one, which is luckily, in this particular case, Obama has said that there will be no more no-bid contracts in the Afghanistan war. So at the very least, those companies that do profit from the war we'll have to compete in the ordinary federal process of choosing contractors. I think it is very troubling that the Pentagon has contracted out a good deal of its activities. We even have essentially mercenaries guarding our troops, being paid really high salaries. It has harmed our troops because you can't force civilians into a war zone. Sometimes our troops have not been well served by these private companies. I think that the whole privatization of government movement that took off, especially under Reagan, has, with regard to military affairs, been pernicious and also probably has created yet another set of lobbies for war abroad, and so is unfortunate for our republic.
Thank you very much for the call, David. We go next to Richard from Fort Atkinson. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of questions. The first is that at the beginning of his speech, Mr. Obama laid the responsibility for 9/11 on the Taliban. Now, we attacked Afghanistan within a month and a half after 9/11. We had not even assessed at that point what the details and actual particulars of 9/11 consisted. The people who bombed 9/11 were Saudis and Egyptians who had trained in Germany, Spain, and the United States. There was no suggestion at the time that the Taliban or Afghanistan was involved. I do not understand that at all. The second question is, you hear frequent references to the American intent to build a pipeline across Afghanistan from the Caspian Sea under, I think it was a proposed contract from Unocal. I'd like to know if that is still a live issue. Finally, Mr. Obama, at the end of his speech, waxed rhapsodic about our noble ideals, and he said, we do not want to occupy other lands. Well, we have between 700 and 1,000 military bases all over the world. We occupy the entire world. I just don't understand some of the hype that is going on with respect to this matter.
Professor Cole.
With regard to the first point, the problem, I agree with the caller that it's likely that Mullah Omar and the Taliban commanders had no foreknowledge of the 9/11 attacks, that this is something that al-Qaeda did without informing them. Many Pashtun religious activists have in the past few years criticized al-Qaeda quite vehemently for its actions and have regretted the disaster that it brought upon Afghanistan. On the other hand, the Taliban were giving safe haven to al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda was the kind of their paymaster, also provided their best troops, and it's unclear whether the negotiations with Mullah Omar could have succeeded in forcing al-Qaeda out of that country. I think that the United States couldn't have left the 40 terror training camps that were in Afghanistan there simply walked away. I think those camps had to be dismantled. They would have gone on producing terrorist operations against the United States and its allies. So I think if the only way to remove al-Qaeda as an organization, to destroy its command and control and to get rid of those terror training camps, was to overthrow the Taliban, then that was perhaps necessary. And President Obama has, you know, from the very beginning supported that, even though he wasn't in Congress at the time. But what was done subsequently really was to pour in a lot of NATO and U.S. troops. And it's suspicious to me that the opposition to the Karzai government has risen in the Pashtun areas in direct proportion to how many troops there have been there. So when we had few troops, there was little opposition. Now we've got a lot, and there's a lot of opposition.
The thing that astounds me, Professor Cole, is that this has been going on for 8 years. This is a long period of time.
Well, yes, but it should be remembered that if you went back to 2002, 2003, 2004, there wasn't very much going on there. I mean, Mexico is worse now than Afghanistan was then. And there was a lot of thinking that the development work that was being done, the road building and so forth, would give a fillip to the economy. And the economy has grown very substantially, although from such a low level that the percentages are more impressive than the reality. So I think the war really only heated up from about 2006. And you say it's been 8 years, but it's been 8 years for the United States and NATO. It's been since 1979 for the Afghans.
Right.
This is a generational war for them. 2 million dead.
Oh,
2 million displaced internally, 5 million displaced externally, entire generations brought up in poverty, having lost all their property, people ethnically cleansed. This is one of the worst human rights situations in the world, and it was produced by a struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union over control of that territory.
What kind of support, the president mentioned our allies, what kind of support is he likely to get from NATO?
Well, NATO leaders want to support Obama to the extent that they can politically. And they will send a few more troops. So Spain is sending an extra 400 and Britain is putting in 500 and so forth. This is not going to be a big thing. The entire European Union only has about 12,000 extra troops for duty abroad, so there's simply not going to be a huge surge from the European side. But although European countries' leaders have supported the Afghanistan mission inside NATO, European publics don't like this war at all. And the polling is very clear. I mean, if you had a referendum in Spain, Italy, France, they would vote to pull out now. And so there's a lot of pressure on the politicians to find an exit strategy. Even Gordon Brown, who is among the more forceful supporters of the war, is starting to talk about a way out. Stephen Harper in Canada has announced that the Canadians are leaving in 2012, and he was a stalwart supporter of the war. So there's just, as you say, it's been a long time, and there's wear and tear on people's nerves. And so it seems to me that we're coming to the end of our ability to expect European support. Moreover, aside from the Anglophone and French-speaking countries, very few European countries have been willing to put their troops in active combat zones. They think of this as a peacekeeping mission, not as a war-fighting mission. And so there was enormous pressure from then-Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld on the Italians and others to come south to fight in the Pashtun areas, and they always resisted that pressure. They stayed up north among the Tajiks, the Uzbeks, the Hazaras, who kind of like the West and appreciate what we're doing for them and where there's not so much trouble.
Here's an interesting email that's come in from Scott. It amazes me that several of your listeners somehow don't believe President Obama. If Obama's assessment is of a United States threat with immediate withdrawal, there is a threat. It seems risky to me to second-guess this move when our leader has made such an about-face. Could it possibly be that we don't have all the security information he does?
Well, it's not an about-face. President Obama, well before he was president, was a hawk on Afghanistan. He has long felt that the Bush administration took its eye off the ball, that the mission is in Afghanistan and Pakistan, that the U.S. should have finished off al-Qaeda. We shouldn't be talking about how many al-Qaeda there are or where they are. We should know that. We should have destroyed the organization altogether. And we should have put Afghanistan on a stable footing. And he blames the Bush administration for running off and spending $1 trillion on a fruitless quagmire in Iraq instead of getting the job done. So it's not a change in his position. This is consistent. What he has said last night was consistent with his political philosophy as he has enunciated it for years and years. Whether it's all right to second-guess the president with regard to his view of American security challenges is something that I still feel strongly about. And we're in a republic. We're in a democracy. Everybody is good as everybody else and their uncle. We were told for 8 years by Dick Cheney that we're not allowed to challenge the president or the vice president, apparently, on these kinds of issues. I like Obama, but I don't agree with him about sending more troops to Afghanistan. And I think that people who feel that way should speak out.
Thanks, Richard, for your call. We go next to Chester from Mill Bluff. Hi, Chester.
Hi. I hear a lot of truth in your guest, and my comment is that the freedom that the politicians say that they're trying to protect the freedom is the freedom for the big businesses and the lobbyists and arms makers to go in these countries to exploit these countries. And that's my comment.
Okay. Professor Cahill?
Well, there isn't any doubt that there is a military-industrial complex that has grown enormously and which is very happy about these wars that we've been involved in. And in fact, if you look at the analysts, the stock analysts' recommendations this morning, you'll find that they're upgrading the munitions-making corporations. And it's also true that behind the scenes, those forces do lobby for war. But we are a democracy, and if we don't want wars, we should counter-lobby. And that's entirely possible, and there are more of us than there are of them. I think that Americans are apathetic. I think that they, in between elections, they're often not paying attention, or they're just assuming that it's none of their business what the executive does. And I think that we need more of a standing peace lobby if we're going to make a difference in policy circles.
They were paying attention at West Point, though, weren't they? Because they may be on their way there soon.
It's not a matter of May.
Right.
The people we saw in that audience, most of them are going to Afghanistan. Mm.
We are welcoming phone calls for Professor Juan Cole. We're talking about the president's speech on Afghanistan, the way forward, what you thought of his words last night, his message. Professor Juan Cole is the Richard Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Tonight, an NPR news special on Obama's decision. You can hear excerpts from his speech, and also there will be comments from Defense Secretary Robert Gates, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Linda Wertheimer will be joined in the studio by NPR political and national security correspondents. Tonight from 6 to 7, you will hear that on the Ideas Network. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, our guest says, as the health care debate enters its decisive stage, liberals in Congress should be ready to trade the public option for provisions that will actually make the reform succeed. Our guest worked in the Clinton administration as a senior health policy advisor. Back to phone calls now for Juan Cole. Anita is next from Illinois. Hi, Anita.
Hi. Great discussion. One of the things that I noticed throughout many of these discussions is that callers have many more facts. They have numbers. They can cite dates. And the reason that there is so much panic out there, but as well as so much more discussion, I think, is because for over 8 years, we were not given facts and figures, and we certainly did not have a president that was as forthcoming and talking with the people and to the people as much as President Obama has been doing. And people frankly are having trouble transitioning. It's like, what do I do with all this information? Oh my God, this guy is falling, Chicken Little, you know. They're not used to being treated like thinking adults. And I think that they just need to, you know, do that transition and realize they're being respected like they haven't been for almost a decade.
Do you think, Anita, that he made his case? Did you like what he said last night?
I did, and I understood it. Do I like the 30,000 troops? No, but I expected it because the military expected it, too. They knew they weren't going to get the 40,000. That's why they asked for 40,000. They knew if they wanted 30,000, they should ask for 40,000, and that's what they're getting. But Obama is also being feared, the troops that are still there. He doesn't want a bloodbath. And so this has to be done in a very wise, thinking manner, not just, oh, you know, with a stroke of a pen and no disregard for life. And so I do respect that.
Professor Cole.
Well, there's not really a question there. I guess what I would say is that the reports given to Congress, which were widely available in PDF form on the web, about the situation in Iraq had a lot of facts and figures in them, too. I'm not sure that there's more information now about Afghanistan than there was about Iraq under Bush. As I said, President Obama alleged that we're fighting al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Jim Jones, the national security advisor, said there are less than 100 al-Qaeda operatives in Afghanistan. We don't need 100,000 troops to fight 100 guys, and they certainly can't hit the United States from the wilds of the Himalayas. President Obama alleged that Pakistan's nuclear arsenal is in danger from the Taliban. Frankly, this allegation is laughable. It is simply incorrect. The Pakistani military is 550,000 men under arms. There are 600,000 reservists. The nuclear arsenal is well secured. It requires a number of passwords to activate. The scruffy Taliban with AK-47s could never get anywhere near that arsenal. And there's I liked Obama. I like Obama. I voted for him. But there is an element of hype in the kinds of allegations that he made about the security threat to the United States from that part of the world that disturbs me. I think there's a little bit of scaremongering here about al-Qaeda and the nuclear issue. And the fact is that sending 30,000 troops to Afghanistan doesn't have anything to do with those other issues anyway. So I'm not sanguine that, in fact, we're being given all the facts. And I think on a number of issues, including renditions and secrecy and so forth, that Obama has had an opportunity to reverse policies of the Bush administration with regard to secrecy and has not taken full advantage of them, and I'm disappointed.
Thank you very much for the call. It seemed to me he is a brilliant speaker, and I think I've heard almost every speech he's ever given. It seems as though he could face criticism for lack of detail. This is a major thing to be doing as president, and I was left wondering at the end of the speech, what exactly are all these troops going to be doing? There's going to be a civilian front. What all's involved in that? Are the troops involved in that? Are they helping to build schools? Are they doing a military thing? Are they training? You know, what exactly is going to happen?
Well, there was a wonderful Frontline program on PBS about 3 weeks ago, which followed troops who were sent into Helmand province to a village with a very similar brief to the one that's being given the new troops being sent out now. And what they did was to go into a village and stay there. They made an operating base at the village, and they declared a market, a bazaar, under their protection and the village under their protection from the Taliban. So they wanted to chase the Taliban out. It's a doctrine that the military calls take, clear, and hold, that instead of raiding into the village and attacking Taliban and then leaving, to stay there and reassure the villagers that the Taliban are not coming back, and then to build local power structures and economy. Over the 3 months that the camera crew was there with this Marine unit in this village in Helmand province, not a single shopkeeper opened their shop in the Marine-protected bazaar. They were too afraid of the Taliban, even with the Marines there.
Really?
And all the time that they were there, they were constantly being sniped at by Taliban. And so their promises to be able to protect the villagers from retribution were made to look hollow, since they couldn't guarantee they themselves weren't going to get killed when they went out on patrol. And the without being polemical or wearing its message on its sleeve, the documentary is a very disturbing indictment of the kind of policy that the military says it wants to pursue in Afghanistan. I mean, their counterinsurgency doctrine assumes that the local people hate the Taliban, are being, you know, intimidated and oppressed by them, and that if only we can rescue them, they will like us better and reorient themselves towards us. And I the thing that struck me was that these are probably their cousins who were calling Taliban, and they're not going to, you know, choose foreign Western white Christians over their cousins under any circumstances. And then the U.S. troops were walking around this village, were in full battle gear, and they were holding their some machine guns up, or their M1 rifles up front, and they looked like, to me, like astronauts. I mean, I can only imagine what the local villagers made of them. And they would say hi and try to be friendly, but the body language and the armor just gave a completely different impression. So I really don't think that what the Pashtun people want is more Marines in their villages, and this is what we're giving them.
Mm-hmm. What about, we had Christiane Amanpour with us a couple months ago. She did a documentary from Afghanistan, and there was a lot of attention paid to schools that had been built and people from the U.S. military who were involved in helping to build those schools, smiling children who were, in some cases, sitting outside because the schools weren't quite done. But is there a lot of work being done like that that villagers are looking at and saying, whoa, this is okay?
Sure. And the most effective work that's been done is of that sort. But, the thing that I want to underline is that Afghanistan is just not a single place. So if you're in the Tajik or the Hazara or the Uzbek areas, I know that these are exotic words for people, but this is the social reality of Afghanistan. Mostly people are very happy to have NATO there and the U.S., and they suffered under the Taliban. They hate the Taliban. But if you're in Helmand province or Kandahar province or possibly Khost or Kunar, these are Pashtun provinces in the east and the south, there are a lot of people around who just don't want any foreigners in their country. And indeed, you know, there are people there who don't like the government, who don't want, they consider the Kabul government to be foreign. Matthew Ho, who resigned from being over there, told an anecdote about how one village revolted against Karzai. There were 2,000 tribesmen who took up arms because the government had sent a census taker and had inquired of the names of their womenfolk. And they were just outraged that the central government should be bringing up the names of their womenfolk, and they revolted. So, you know, in a situation where people don't like their own government, to come into their affairs. What are they going to think about a foreign government doing so?
Let's go to John from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Well, the speech last night was so eerily similar in rhetoric to Thomas Woodrow Wilson's war address to Congress on April 4th, 1917, and Obama basically metaphorically saying, "Here I stand, I can do no other," just as Wilson did. And there is this theme of war that we cannot get beyond in the presidency. And I think that's why it's so terribly important that the peace movement just become ever more vigilant, even to the point of having a peace party in this country. We cannot allow these decisions to just keep being made. The military seems just to be wanting to make these decisions to have a war somewhere to execute. It doesn't matter where it is, if it's in Vietnam or in Somalia or in Central America or in the mountains of Afghanistan. And I think that we need to be terribly vigilant about this during the next 2.5 years of the Obama administration.
Professor Cole.
Well, I don't disagree. I think that, you know, it used to be in the Constitution that Congress was the one that declared war. The last time Congress did so was World War II. And all of the wars we've had subsequently have been presidential directives, which has increasingly made us more like an empire than like a republic. In a republic, the people decide. The people never were given a chance to decide whether we should go to war in Iraq, for instance. There never was a declaration of war on Iraq by our elected representatives. I'm very troubled by this situation. We spend more on our military than the next 40 countries combined. And it's getting to the point where we spend 25 times as much as the UK, which is a pretty militarized society. We are becoming Spartans in a way. Our economy is collapsing around us. Essential infrastructure, bridges and so forth, are not being repaired. And we're running off to build schools in Afghanistan and fight battles in distant places on the grounds that the shadowy, asymmetrical, and tiny terrorist groups might have safe haven in such places. I mean, if the problem is terrorism, it should be being addressed by counterterrorism, including by good police work. We don't need 100,000 troops to fight terrorism, and they wouldn't be any good at it anyway. And so we've gotten ourselves involved in nation building and preemptive wars and things that I think that our founding fathers are spinning in their graves. I mean, they were very much against Washington, Jefferson, Madison, all of them against this kind of foreign adventurism.
Another email from Rick from Madison. Given that many other countries have suffered from terrorist attacks, including Britain, Spain, and India, what would be a likely scenario if the U.S. decided to pull out and let the chips fall where they may? For example, would not India have concerns about an unstable Afghanistan leading to an unstable Pakistan?
Sure. And India put enormous pressure on Obama not to withdraw from Afghanistan. I mean, there's an international dimension here. Russia, India, China all have an interest in the situation in Afghanistan stabilizing and pressured Washington to try to stabilize it before it left. Moreover, one of the problems in Afghanistan is that there's a behind-the-scenes struggle there between India and Pakistan for influence in the country. At the moment, India has the upper hand and is putting millions into foreign aid. Pakistan is sulking, having lost control of Afghanistan since the Taliban were a Pakistani project. And going forward, unless that struggle between India and Pakistan can somehow be resolved, there's likely to be continued trouble in the country with the regional powers backing proxies inside Afghanistan.
Oh, there is so much here. Professor Cole, always a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
It's wonderful for you to have me on, Kathleen. Take care.
Yeah, you too. Professor Juan Cole, our guest this hour, Richard Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan. He's also written a number of books, Engaging the Muslim World. He's also written Sacred Space and Holy War in Napoleon's Egypt. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. A reminder, tonight an NPR news special on all of this. You can hear excerpts from the president's speech and excerpts from appearances on Capitol Hill today by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Secretary of Defense, and Secretary of State. Special tonight from 6 until 7, hosted by Linda Wertheimer. Thank you for all of your calls, everybody. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with more Wednesday conversation here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.